Live from GPB News, this is Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. Today, Brian Kemp and Stacey Abrams go head-to-head in their first general election debate.
This race is about the soul of our future, and I'd be honored to have your vote.
I've learned the values of family, faith, service, and responsibility for my parents, and those are the values I will take when I leave Georgia, and I humbly ask for your vote.
Did we learn anything new about the candidates? Who got the better of the often fiery exchanges? Did Libertarian candidate Ted Metz gain the exposure he wants to force a runoff in the governor's race?
A vote for me is a protest vote to show them that you're sick and tired of the same old stuff.
We'll get analysis from our panel of insiders. Plus, how did Georgia's congressional candidates fare in their debates? Gun control and charges of tax fraud dominate the 6th District debate, while candidates in the 7th District spar over President Trump's tariffs. First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Authorities in New York say there appears to be a connection between suspected explosive devices sent to top Democratic political figures in the New York City area and Washington, D.C. NPR's Joel Rose reports New York Governor Andrew Cuomo says his office received one of the devices.
Police and elected officials held a press conference outside the New York office of CNN, which was evacuated after one of the suspected explosive devices was discovered in the mailroom. An NYPD official said the devices appear to be pipe bombs and that one individual or individuals apparently sent multiple similar packages. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo said his office also received one.
A number of devices have been sent. They're being handled. We wouldn't be surprised if additional devices are sent.
Former President Obama and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton are also among the prominent Democratic politicians who've received the suspected explosive devices. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
Well, in addressing the suspicious package sent to her, Hillary Clinton told an audience in Miami, Florida today about the political climate in general.
It is a troubling time, isn't it? And it's a time of deep divisions, and we have to do everything we can to bring our country together.
A few of the devices appear to have had Democratic Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz's contact as the return address. This all coming a day after a bomb was confirmed to be found near the New York area compound of billionaire philanthropist George Soros, who is a major donor to progressive causes. In other news, Jamal Khashoggi's death is putting many world leaders in a tough position this day. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports French President Emmanuel Macron is now under pressure after German Chancellor Angela Merkel called on Europeans to stop arms exports to Saudi Arabia.
Macron refused to answer questions about halting arms sales to Saudi Arabia. A clearly irritated Macron told journalists their questions had nothing to do with his current activity. The clash occurred Thursday evening while Macron was visiting a defense technology show on the outskirts of Paris. Macron has sought to play down the importance of trade relations with Riyadh, saying that Saudi Arabia is not a major client of France. However, from 2008 to 17, the Gulf country was the second biggest purchaser of French weapons, with deals totaling nearly $13 billion for tanks, armored vehicles, munitions, and artillery. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
The Dow is down 243 points, nearly 1% at 24,947. The Nasdaq is down 2.5%, S&P down 1.5%. This is NPR.
Live from the GPB Newsroom, good afternoon. I'm Drew Dawson. Just ahead, it's Political Rewind with Bill Nigut, but first in GPB News. The candidates for Georgia's hotly contested governor's race had their first television debate last night. GPB's Stephen Fowler reports they spent a large part of the debate talking about voting rights.
Midway through the debate, Republican Brian Kemp was asked if he used his position as Secretary of State to suppress minority voters in elections. His response?
If you look at the numbers, minority participation in Georgia's up 23%. We have 1 million more people on our voter rolls today than we had when I took office.
But Democrat Stacey Abrams said voter suppression was about more than being on the rolls.
It's also about creating an atmosphere of fear, making people worry that their votes won't count.
The pair have clashed in recent weeks over everything from rejected absentee ballots to Georgia's strict voter registration law. They both face Libertarian Ted Metz in November. For GPB News, I'm Stephen Fowler in Atlanta.
Meanwhile, the NAACP has filed complaints with election officials alleging that some voting machines in Bartow and Dodge counties showed votes that were cast for Stacey Abrams registering for Brian Kemp. Phyllis Blake, president of the Georgia NAACP, tells USA Today that the group plans to file two more complaints involving voting machines in Henry and Cobb counties. In sports, the Atlanta Hawks host the Dallas Mavericks tonight in their home opener at the newly revamped State Farm Arena. Tip-off is at 7:30. The Hawks are currently in 11th place in the NBA East with a 1-win, 2-loss record. For more Georgia news, go to gpbnews.org and follow us on Facebook and on Twitter.
Support for NPR comes from C3 IoT, powering enterprise digital transformation with artificial intelligence, predictive analytics, and IoT solutions. Learn more at c3iot.ai and the Kresge Foundation at kresge.org.
Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. We're coming to you, if you're listening to us in real time, the afternoon after the first head-to-head confrontation between Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp, the two candidates for governor, debated last night here in the studios of Georgia Public Broadcasting, the debate sponsored by the Atlanta Press Club, and also brought to you courtesy of the building security and maintenance people. Who heard the fire alarm go off, Greg Bluestein, about 5 minutes, maybe less.
Right in the middle of my question.
Right in the middle of your question. And they, thank goodness, it only took them about 4 minutes to correct it. But it was an embarrassing beginning to the debate, we all have to admit.
It was a fiery open. Thank God there wasn't actually real fire. Yeah. It was not a real threat. Yeah. It was just a faulty wiring, apparently.
Yeah. We're going to talk about the debate and get everybody in the studio's reaction to it. That's, of course, Greg Bluestein. He's political reporter for the AJC. He was on the panel last night and got to ask, I think, I count, you got about four questions in?
Four full questions and one yes, no, because we had about 20 seconds left at the very end.
Actually, in a minute, we're going to talk about what that yes, no question was, because it's important. So Greg is with us. Audrey Haynes is back with us today. She, of course, is an associate professor of political science at the University of Georgia. She's also oversees you're the director of the Applied Politics Certificate Program.
Yes, I am.
Which we have said to our listeners a couple times in explaining it, you're really preparing your political science students for work in the field of politics.
Yes, and we work with the Grady School of Journalism to help students who are interested in political communications to prepare for that arena of work. In fact, Greg has come and participated in the program as well. So we interact with a lot of practitioners in the state and at the national level.
Loretta Lepore is here. She is a Republican strategist. She's the former press secretary to former Governor Sonny Perdue, and she also was the co-chair of Carly Fiorina's presidential campaign. You know, given that you've done political consulting, Loretta, when you hear Audrey say she's preparing students to go into the field of politics, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing. You know, I don't mind them going into it, but I think they really have to understand the dynamics.
Yeah. What does that mean?
Well, I think that sometimes some of the students that are coming into the field don't understand how aggressive it has become as a profession. I mean, my son is a mass comm student and is required to have a minor, so he is also a political science minor, and some of his curriculum, he was telling me today he had a paper due on nationalism. I said, how timely is that, right?
Oh my gosh.
And I think there are a lot of careers, and it's good general knowledge about the culture of today that can help you in any profession, quite candidly. I think if you're going into politics, I think one of the things that gets lost is really sharing with kids that they need to know their moral compass before entering the field.
Moral compass and sharp elbows.
Exactly.
We cover that. Cover that. Stephen
Fowler, who is doing political reporting for us here at GPB Radio right now, is also in the studio. Glad you could be here. You covered the debate last night.
I was there. I was there for the fire alarm as well.
Yeah. We're going to be joined in a few minutes by Dr. Andra Gillespie of Emory University. She's running over here after giving a talk downtown at Georgia State University. So we're looking forward to Andra coming in. Before we get into debate conversation, let's talk just for a minute about the news that has really dominated the cycle since first thing this morning. We now know that explosive devices have been found at the homes of the Clintons in New York, in Westchester County, at President Obama's home in D.C., at the CNN New York Bureau, in a package that was addressed to former CIA Director John Brennan, who's, of course, been a really harsh critic of President Trump's. Debbie Wasserman Schultz is another person who's apparently had a suspicious package mailed to her. And according to the authorities, they now believe all these packages may be linked to a bomb that was found in the mailbox of George Soros, who has been a major funder of Democratic and liberal causes. It's troubling, Greg.
Yeah, these are all people who are either critics or perceived to be critics of President Trump. And there's a lot of talk, you know, we don't know the motive or anything like that of a suspect yet. But you know, rhetoric saying the media and people who are against Trump are enemies of the state. You know, that could play into this.
Mike Pence already, the vice president, put out a statement saying that this condemning anybody who would try to use violence, essentially, in service of their political beliefs. And President Trump said, I agree. That was the most that he tweeted in retweeting the vice president's message. Audrey, you had an interesting thought about how this fits into a larger dynamic of American history.
Well, you know, we were talking earlier about just patterns that we see historically when we look at polarization and when those divides become very intense, when certain divides between sides become so rabid, you usually see some sort of response to it. A time in history where we had this kind of divide was prior to the Civil War over an issue. We had become very divided as a country, and we ended up going to war. A lot of people say it's not likely that we're going to go to a physical war, but we may have already entered into what we call our own kind of Cold War, where people are fighting, using whatever kinds of means they have, and disregarding institutional norms and routines, and also disregarding general rules of the game, even in campaigns, to do whatever they can to win.
All right. I just wanted to give you a chance to say that, because it does seem to me we don't know enough at this point, so we don't want to speculate. It is interesting, of course, Loretta, that these explosive devices are all being found at at locations where prominent Democrats either live or work.
That is troubling, and I'm pleased that Vice President Pence came out immediately and spoke against these types of actions.
Yeah, I thought that was a really important, given the partisanship that we're feeling, especially 2 weeks ahead of what many people think is one of the most important midterm election cycles in many, many decades. Dr. Andra Gillespie, Emory University Associate Professor of Political Science, is now with us. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You were over giving a talk at Georgia State University.
I was on a panel, yeah.
Okay. What did you talk about?
How to make elections fair.
Oh, what a perfect way to lead in. What a perfect way to lead into the conversation that we're all going to have about the debate that took place here last night. I want to go around the room before I do anything else and just get your overall impressions of what you saw last night. Then we're going to drill down into specifics. So I'd like you to keep this pretty brief, and I'll start with you, Greg, and we'll literally go around the studio. Just give us a capsule summary of what you saw happen last night.
Yeah, I got a unique view. But to me, the battle for undecideds is over. This was two different candidates talking to two different distinct audiences, not trying to overlap really at all, both looking for base motivating, videos to send to their supporters. They were punching and counterpunching for sure, but they were also just talking to rev up their bases. There's so few undecided voters left, and the focus is not on them. It's focus is on turnout.
I'm glad you said that, because as we go along, we're going to play a few clips that I think will, in fact, substantiate what you're saying. Andra?
I'll agree with Greg. I don't think anybody's mind was changed by anything that was said last night.
Loretta?
Well, I would say that, I don't think anybody really anticipated that there would be minds changed. I think the format of the debate was a little disconcerting, candidly, for folks viewing it. Having a third party there and the questioning of being able to ask, candidate A asking candidate B about candidate C was a little bit disconcerting. And then the opportunity for each of the candidates to kind of rebut. And so you didn't get a real clear, for those people who really wanted to see a clear delineation or wanted to really confirm their votes, you didn't really see that happening in this context between Stacey Abrams in particular and Brian Kemp, the leading candidate.
Sorry. There's been a good deal of criticism on social media about the format of the debate last night. And I think it's worth our looking at, as we continue to talk to the press club, how they proceed, since they're the ones who really determine what the debate's going to look like, who's going to be on the panels, that sort of thing. Stephen, a quick observation from you as a reporter, not an analyst.
Covering both of these candidates on the trail, I was surprised that neither one of them really opened up any new avenues of attacks or messaging in these final 2 weeks. One, Stacey Abrams talked about bipartisanship and Medicaid expansion and things like that, and Kemp continued to hammer home street gangs and things like that. So we're really seeing what the last 2 weeks of this campaign are going to look like from a messaging perspective.
And what about you, Audrey?
Well, I would say that I would agree with a lot that has been said around the table already, but one thing that did stand out to me was that Abrams did convey probably a bit more detail in some of the things she said, and was better able to sneak in what might be a criticism of Kemp without looking like she was on the attack. Kemp, however, had what I thought of was kind of like a Rubio moment, where there was some repetition of things that whenever he had the opportunity, one of the things I saw a lot of people talking about is, I have three daughters, and that would come up a lot. And sometimes it would be juxtaposed with, fighting gangs, I have three daughters. And sometimes that just reminded me of repeating sound bites that he was told he needed to get out there.
And that could also be a subtle gig, a subtle dig at Stacey Abrams for being single and not having children. And that's something his campaign's highlighted, his marriage and his family and all that throughout.
Except he kept calling her Mrs. Abrams.
He would go back and forth.
So I would argue that I think that they were targeting voters at this point. We know who Abrams has been targeting, because I've been getting all of the direct mail, and there has been a picture of a woman on every single one of them, or a very seedy picture of Kemp on another one. So, I mean, she seemed to be going after rural voters. And she added that thing that piqued my ears a lot, where she was talking about a living wage for people who were officers of the state. That was new to me.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard it before. And Kemp, again, he talked more about the same things he didn't open up to something new like I hoped he would be.
Andre, you wanted to weigh in?
Sorry.
Well, I would say that, Stacey Abrams, like Brian Kemp, talking about his family, also referred to her family quite often in several contexts, when talking about the gang violence and drug trafficking, referencing her brother. And then when she was on the defense about her personal debt, it was talking about caring for her parents. And so, we heard a lot of their personal issues coming into this forum from both sides.
All right, could we listen to some sound? You've all commented on the fact that Stacey Abrams was focused on issues last night throughout much of it. You've said that in one way or another, that she gave a lot of detail in terms of positions she's taken in the race. And of course, one of the things that we know about Stacey Abrams is that she has made expanding Medicaid the top issue in her campaign. Let's listen to how she said it last night.
I'm so bullish on Medicaid expansion because I know it works. It's a bipartisan, proven solution that even Governor Mike Pence did in the state of Indiana. Georgia has more rural hospitals on the brink of closure than almost any other state. And unless we expand Medicaid, draw down the $3 billion to which we are entitled, and invest it in Georgia, we will not be able to build the strongest rural Georgia that we need.
What you're hearing here is probably going to be her closing message. Nationally, you're hearing Democrats, look, 4 years ago, 6 years ago, this was the Republican attack. It was Obamacare it needs to be repealed. It was Obamacare is the root of a lot of needless government bureaucracy. Now you're hearing Democrats all over the nation seize on Medicaid expansion because poll after poll after poll shows a majority of voters in different states approve of some form of expansion. And this is the line Stacey Abrams has said throughout, which is pointing to Mike Pence, pointing to other Republican governors in red states who also have embraced Medicaid expansion.
Andre, does it strike you as you've watched this race unfold and when you think about that soundbite and others like it last night, that Abrams has done a maybe do voters have potentially a better understanding of the things that she wants to do at this point than Kemp? Her message seems more focused than his. Doesn't mean people are going to like the message.
Right. Well, I mean, I think naturally Abrams is more of a policy wonk than Kemp. And so I think she has some natural advantages here in terms of being able to talk about issues in details because this is a natural home for her. At the end of the day, I think there is a lot of negative partisanship that's influencing what's going on here. And so by negative partisanship, I mean that people identify with the opposite of what they believe in. And so people who are inclined to vote for Brian Kemp are voting for him in part because he's not a Democrat or he's not Stacey Abrams. And so in that respect, it actually really doesn't matter whether or not he's more or less detailed than she is.
Well, I would say that also on the Republican side, to your point, if you've got this bifurcated electorate, that for Republicans, what they hear when Stacey Abrams talks about Medicaid expansion, and I hear this over and over again, is she's going to be a big government governor. She's going to expand government every opportunity that she has. And so there's that on the surface. On the second level, the one thing that really bothered me that she said about Medicaid expansion last night was that it was the only solution. And when you're governing, you have to really be creative. And to think that Medicaid expansion is going to solve all of our healthcare ills is just it's a promise she can't keep. Because in our rural communities, the closest thing to healthcare are community pharmacists. In some of our counties, we have no doctors. The community pharmacist is acting as the lead healthcare professional in certain parts of our rural in some of our rural communities. So to say that it's going to solve all the problems of healthcare in rural Georgia is not true because we don't have doctors for these patients to see.
It is Audrey, drill down a little bit into what Loretta is saying. She certainly has showcased Medicaid as the expansion as the key issue in her race. I have not heard her say that it is the only thing we need to do to fix our entire healthcare system, however.
Well, I haven't heard that either. I think she's focused on that primarily because she's interested in rural reinvigoration, and that is one part of one of the things she's talking about. How do you bring people into rural areas? They're not going to go there if there's no doctors. And doctors aren't going to practice somewhere when people don't have enough money to pay them. But Medicaid expansion sometimes will help with that.
I mean, I think I would add sort of the focus on rural hospitals as being something that was related but a little bit separate from Medicaid expansion.
Well, it is different, but it is tied in because there's the reimbursement.
Yeah.
Component of that.
Her argument is not that it's a chicken egg, but she said it's a horse and the cart. They kind of go together hand in hand. And his argument is that less regulations and more flexibility to spend federal dollars on what you might choose to spend it on would lead to more development.
And so when you look at Mike Pence's plan, when Mike Pence expanded Medicaid in Indiana, there is a component in there that certain Medicaid recipients at certain thresholds have to contribute some of their own dollars. It's not totally paid for by the state or the federal government, that there's an expectation, on some sliding scale that Medicaid recipients at certain levels pay in. And if they don't, they will lose their coverage. And so she doesn't go on to talk about those types of things, whereas you're right, is that Brian Kemp is looking at a way to say, yes, we do need to draw down those federal funds. They belong to Georgians. And we can look at waivers as a way to do that, as a lot of states have done, including Wisconsin recently and Arkansas. And how do we make that system fit for Georgia?
Abrams was critical in the debate of Kemp. She says he didn't have a health care plan at all. That's not quite correct. He's introduced the notion that he would ask for federal waivers. But, Greg, you cover these two pretty closely. When Kemp talks about waivers, the waivers he wants would provide subsidies for people who are buying insurance on the exchange already, which doesn't take into consideration all of those underserved Georgians who Abrams wants to insure through Medicaid expansion. Is that correct?
Yeah, and I private insurance, sort of, they call it stability waivers, not for Medicaid. In his words, it's for Affordable Care Act, so these are not Medicaid waivers he's asking for. But it has been, you're right, it has been a weakness for Kemp for a long time, because for the longest time, his health care plan was mostly revolving around his opposition to Medicaid expansion. It wasn't until about 2 or 3 weeks ago down in Cook County in Adel, Georgia, where he did unveil a more detailed health care platform. But until then, Abrams was hammering Kemp for only having a 7-word or so health care platform.
But Stephen, you were in the studio, or you were in the control room, you were one place or the other, watching this debate unfold last night. One of the things that struck me, if one of the ways in which we define how this debate unfolded was Abrams trying to stick to the message that she's put out throughout the campaign, I think it's fair to say that another way that we can look at this debate is how Kemp hammered away at Abrams and tried to delegitimize her as a candidate for governor. I want to play just a little bit of his closing argument, or his closing statement, and then ask you to comment about it. Here was the opportunity at the end for Abrams and Kemp to say what they stood for.
This election is a fight for our future. My opponent has run the most dishonest campaign Georgians have ever seen, and here's why. She's lying about my record to hide her extreme agenda. She wants higher taxes, bigger government, a single-payer, radical government takeover of health care. And those are her moderate positions. She also wants to give taxpayer benefits, welfare, and free college tuition to those here illegally. And she's even asking illegals to vote for her in this race. Not even California is that liberal.
So, Stephen, I have to say that I understand in the midterm election cycle that we're in, where you've got a president who's out there pounding away at Democrats left and right, that Kemp wants to, again, disqualify her as a legitimate candidate for governor. But that seemed like a very harsh way to want to close out your argument in a debate.
Well, so it's par for the course with what the Kemp campaign and some of the state Republican Party messaging that's gone out against Abrams. They've seized on this quote that Abrams said at a campaign event with Senator Elizabeth Warren that I was at, where she said the blue wave is coming in Georgia, and she lists off different people and different things that are in it. And she says it includes undocumented and documented people. And in the context of that speech, Abrams says that it was who's going to be supportive and who's in Georgia and who she's there representing. But it's one of the many things that have been used to attack Abrams as too radical, too liberal for Georgia. There have been mailers sent out calling her, you know, Comrade Stacy, that she's some socialist, communist, liberal. So this closing statement really sums up the method of attacking Abrams and her policies, that she doesn't represent Georgia, she doesn't belong in Georgia, and that's kind of what Kemp's saying there.
What'd y'all think of that?
Well, and I would say I would put that into the literature where they talk about the motive behind that kind of messaging, fear messages, fear ads. They tend to heighten attentiveness. People pay more attention to that. They hear it, and it weakens people's reliance on partisan cues. So that is a way for him to kind of chip away, to generate maybe some flaking from people who are weak partisans on the left or independents.
So part of it's a common national trope. You tie the candidates to extremists in the hopes that it will demobilize folks and sort of undercut their support. But then there also becomes the issue of if we are going to believe that Brian Kemp really doesn't point guns at teenagers, so that primary version of Brian Kemp isn't the general election version of Brian Kemp, then we also have to understand and put into context what Stacey Abrams was saying. And so in that context, I think she was talking about who she intended to govern, not necessarily who she was trying to get to vote for her. Now, the wording of it sort of opens the door to allow for that type of interpretation, but adults should actually be able to be a little bit more discerning and understand that she really was not trying to say that she wanted undocumented
people
to
vote. Well, you know, yes, but what's interesting is that that was just one of the pieces of Kemp's attack that was part of a larger picture. Yes, he said she wants undocumented, he called them illegals, to vote, which we've dissected on this show. We've read what she actually said over and over again. She doesn't seem to have really said that. But still, Greg, the overall tone of that closing, you're either going to love that because you're a bright red Republican who's all for, you know, going after the liberal mob that he would say she's a part of, or maybe if you're a suburban woman still trying to figure out how you're going, you might wonder about that kind of closing.
But he's not. The purpose
it's
of this debate
with that.
Wasn't trying to get those undecided women.
Right.
This 30-second clip of video will be sent to all of his supporters to mobilize them to go to the base. That's all he wanted from this debate, I think.
Loretta?
Well, and we're seeing voter turnout on the Republican side up, considerably.
Yep.
So I think the NBC had a poll 9% up for Republicans.
Here in Georgia.
And they want to keep that momentum going. Right.
There were some issues
here in Georgia, yes.
There were some issues with the poll, but we are seeing definitely
momentum on the Republican side
you look
that
at
wasn't
Katusha
there
County,
before.
Forsyth County, Chair, all these red counties. Mm-hmm. The same sort of epic turnout that Democratic counties are having.
All right, let me do this. Let me get a break out of the way and come back. We're going to keep talking about the debate for a while. By the way, if you have comments you want to make about the debate, we're on Facebook Live right now. Just come to the GPB News page on Facebook or tweet us at PoliticsGPB. It'll be interesting to see what you have to say. Maybe we'll try to get a couple of your comments in. This is Political Rewind. We'll be right back.
Hey, this is David Green, host of Morning Edition. I'm here to talk with you about that poking feeling, the one that keeps reminding you to support public radio. You can support the programs you love by donating your used vehicle. That old car or truck could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station. All you have to do is call, and you might even receive a tax deduction.
Go to gpb.org/cars or call 877-GPB-1-CAR, and thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Of course, voter suppression has been an issue that the Democrats have been hammering away at throughout this election. And it's been getting, Andrew, we all know, a lot of national attention as well. So last night, let's play it. Brian Kemp responded to a question. I think it was Lisa Raham, who was moderating, who asked him whether, in fact, he was ready to say unequivocally there is no effort at voter suppression by his office?
Absolutely not. And voters should look at the numbers and know that this is all a distraction to take away from Ms. Abrams' extreme agenda that she has for a government takeover of health care, wanting to give the Hope Scholarship to those that are here illegally, in many, many other radical positions, having to raise taxes for $13,000 per person in our state to pay for all of this. If you look at the numbers, minority participation in Georgia is up 23%. We have 1 million more people on our voter rolls today than we had when I took office. We've had record turnouts in our last presidential election, and we're having record turnouts right now.
So that's Kemp. Everybody want to how did he do with that, Audrey?
That was probably one of the better responses, I think, that he had given during the debate. Sometimes he can be very monotone-ish, and it's easy to, stop hearing him. That's one thing I would tell him to work on a little bit. But I talked to someone who works for him canvassing and says that people love that because he sounds just like them, and they all say that. But it was not bad. And he's repeating things people have heard 1 million times, so it's sticking into their web of information.
I mean, I think the problem is that there's some people who just don't trust that. And they're really skeptical of that. And they're really skeptical when they hear, stories of people who, were pending and didn't know or had their absentee ballot rejected and they didn't know. And so, I mean, I think that this is one sort of a, symptomatic of a larger problem of a mistrust of government. And so, he's going to have to sort of address those issues. And if there is any report at all of somebody who allegedly registered to vote and they go to the polls on election day and they can't find their name anywhere, then it's game over for him.
That is a problem.
And that was Abrams' response, too, is if there's just one voter who's being denied the chance to cast ballots, it's one too many. And her line throughout this whole entire, she hasn't seized on any, for the most part, on any one single voter registration issue. It's more of, this is a pattern, a part of a pattern of misconduct, she says, that raises the question of whether or not he should be allowed to stay in office while
I think that's really an important point. You know, Loretta, Kemp can point to more and more people voting and registering, and that's correct. But that really doesn't deal with whether there's suppression on the other end of that. And when you have an incident, as Greg says, any one incident, unfortunately, can help advance a scenario that your opponents are trying to create. Jefferson County senior citizens being taken off a bus, African Americans, and not allowed to go to the polls because county officials in a Republican county essentially said, well, this may be, isn't it a Republican county?
It's a blue county. That went for Clinton. I don't know how the county commission holds.
Well, and all those folks have voted now, right? The county took them all and they've all voted. And the residents themselves said they didn't feel that there was an issue of voter suppression.
Well, yeah, but the point is, it's the symbol, isn't it?
Well, you're saying that it's feeding into a narrative, and it's important to counteract the narrative. And I think that Brian Kemp has come out in the last couple of days, even prior to the debate, talking on morning radio and so forth, trying to correct this narrative that was put out there. And, you know, and I even heard Kevin Riley, the editor of the AJC, earlier this week talk about this, that you had, you know, Stacey Abrams go out into the national media and all of her surrogates saying these folks couldn't vote. It was a false narrative. They can vote. And everybody out there that's listening should know that they can vote. But the problem was that if we did not have responsible journalists here in the state, and this is where there's a divide, right, where we have got people in the state and journalists in the state correcting the record, staying on top of it every day, that is counter what the national narrative is. And so it is very important for the campaigns, in particular the Kemp campaign, to be forthcoming about how this works.
But all of which is fine. But Audrey's point, that this is one of Kemp's better answers, is fine, except I don't think, I mean, he has not, to the best of my knowledge, answered anything about these specific kinds of concerns that people are raising. Am I missing it?
What do you mean?
Well, I didn't hear him, for instance, say the folks in Jefferson County did get to cast their ballots. Yes, I know there was some concern.
Well, his overall argument on those issues is that these are county issues. These are you know, the polling precincts, the closures. A lot of these issues are counties. And the first question I asked him was about whether or not he would resign, and that was one of his first answers. Was, as you know, a lot of this.
Yes.
In his words.
It happens at the county level.
Who know how the process works, they know that. And I think a lot of those responses are because, isn't it obvious? I don't need to explain that anymore. But what he doesn't understand is that, you know, 90% don't understand how that works. And that he's actually helping feed the narrative himself.
Thank you for articulating that much better than I was trying to.
People see poll closures and issues like what happened in Jefferson County, and it's natural to think that's the Secretary of State's purview, even if it's not necessarily.
Well, he did that same answer with the local office holders, and it, he seemed almost cold in response to these state troopers who are on food stamps, whereas Abrams seems so warm. I'm going to stand with them, and I'm going to make sure they get a living wage. And he's like, well, that's not my thing. I do. That is the county.
But, you know, back to the point about how the Secretary of State's office works and things, I've been covering the election system and how it works and different things, and finding that most people don't exactly know how things work. And even the elections officials themselves, they may have training. There's an 85-page poll worker training manual. But at the end of the day, it's normal people that are helping run this election system that may not get things done. But Kemp at the top is who most people see responsible for this. But on the flip side, on the Kemp campaign, when they have the articles that come out and say that, oh, these people can't vote on the pending list, that actually ends up benefiting the Kemp campaign more, because he can say, look, these people are misrepresenting how I do my job and how my job works. And so then there's, you know, it's this, yes, he corrects the record about what he does, but at the same time, it ultimately ends up benefiting his message to his base, that the media, the national media and other things don't know what's going on, and they're trying to paint him as some sort of villain when he's just doing his job.
All right. I want to turn to another aspect of the debate. Andre, let me, if I can, throw this out to you. We've heard almost nothing from Ted Metz, the libertarian running for governor. He has really not been out campaigning, to the best of my knowledge. I think until last night, people weren't even sure there was a third candidate on the ballot. I leave it up to each person to decide whether Metz acquitted himself well or not last night. But I wonder, The fact that we have a race that almost every poll suggests is neck and neck, whether just his very presence in this debate last night might be enough for people who aren't really happy with either the Republican or the Democrat to think, well, what the heck, if I'm going to vote, I should throw my vote to the Libertarian. He himself said that, of course, in the debate. He said, we're going to have a runoff, and I want you to vote for me to get us there.
Well, I mean, so there are a number of issues to kind of think about with that. I think because this race is going to be close, regardless of sort of who comes in first place or not, because I think the margin is going to be so narrow, that means that neither candidate has the type of cushion that necessarily guarantees that they're going to get over 50%. So that's the place where he can play spoiler. Sort of saying, you know, just vote for me to make sure that, you know, we have a runoff. I don't know if that's necessarily terribly convincing.
I suspect that's right. But he does. He could be a protest vote. Yes,
he could potentially be a protest vote. I mean, if it were just on the merits of his performance, my take on it was that he was not ready for prime time at all.
It was kind of unfortunate.
Yeah, the campaign operatives I talked to were not happy he was part of the debate, and hopefully he won't be a part of the debate in WSB in a week and a half. But he will.
Yeah, they've already said they are going to invite him.
But they were also thrilled with how he came off, because they're hopeful that those 2% numbers that he's at every poll will even continue to shrink, thereby making it less likely that there's a runoff, because neither campaign is all that excited. Both of them want this knockout punch. If there's a runoff, it tends to favor the Republican in Georgia. Mm-hmm. So that's especially worrying for Stacey Abrams' campaign. But the emphasis on hemp for a lot of the different answers, you know, he sort of became a laughingstock. And this was his first real event. I mean, if you compare this to 4 years ago when you had Andrew Hunt, who was actually out on the campaign trail, we saw a lot of him. He got a lot of coverage because he was out and about. Ted Metz has not been out to nearly the level that the other Libertarian candidates have been. So it'll be harder for him to drive up his margin.
I want to turn to one other thing in the debate before we get to our next break. And Greg, it comes down to you and your question, which you said before you only had an opportunity. Two questions that you asked that we should talk about. One of them is, I thought you asked a great question of Brian Kemp. You've been criticized for continuing your job as Secretary of State and overseeing an election that you're a major participant in. If you're not going to step aside, essentially, you said, with the election approaching, will you, in fact, step aside if there's a recount? That was an interesting question.
Yeah, I really wanted to get him on whether or not he felt like he could impartially continue to oversee the state's elections, which he said before, and he said it again, why. He said he had a job to do, and he was elected to do the job, and he's going to do it. But state law requires the Secretary of State's office to direct a recount if it's within that margin of, I think it's 0.5%. And he said, if it's a recount, you know, my office is very well equipped to do this. The state law requires me to do this, and I'll continue to do it. Which, you know, if it comes down to that, will be a giant national story, and we'll be able to look back to this debate to see his answer on it.
Andre, I've asked the question on this show repeatedly. Why didn't Kemp anticipate this? I get that other secretaries of state running for office haven't stepped aside, but we've never had as much scrutiny on ballot security, on issues regarding the ballot that we have right now and have had for the entire year. He could have stepped aside a long time ago. He didn't. But now to say, well, I'm still Secretary of State, even in a recount, that strikes me as something that voters might be a little nervous about.
Well, I mean, so here are a couple of things to think about. Let's flip that on its head. I have full confidence that his office is a well-oiled machine and can do this stuff without him. And so if they can do it without him, then why not excuse yourself from the process, right? Because this suggests that you don't trust your staff on the one hand. And so there are some managerial issues that you may want to think about. And then there are these larger optical issues to think about, overseeing your own election. Like, there's just something inherently unethical about this. And there's no rule against it, but just because it's not against a rule doesn't mean that it's necessarily right. And then there's the larger questions to think about. So not sort of, you know, what other people did before you. Why do we let partisans control the electoral process? Like, this is something that I think many states need to seriously rethink.
Yeah. Here's an example. I thought we had an example. I'll start with you on this, Audrey, yesterday, of where his candidacy and his office come into conflict. We talked yesterday about this Rolling Stone tape the tape of Kemp telling a private gathering, you know, Democrats are registering a lot of people. They've been very successful. They're getting them out to vote. We've got to pump up our vote operation. And Rolling Stone put a spin on it that was somewhat diabolical. This was something Kemp was doing in a kind of an evil way. What I heard was a candidate saying to supporters, man, they're energized. We better get energized, too. That's fine, except that candidate is also the Secretary of State. And it seems to me a moment when those optics really look bad for him.
Yes, I agree with what Andrew said. That is, you said it perfectly. I mean, it is a question of optics. When I read that, I thought, well, that he's right. They have spent millions of dollars on this absentee ballot initiative. And, you know, they're seeing some good turnout and feedback on that. So he's concerned about that. And he's trying to rally the troops because the thing they're most concerned about is their base of voters not being as motivated because they're in control of everything. Things look good. We're not worried. And a big part of them being, you know, Trump loyalists who their person's not on the ticket. So maybe I'm going to stay home and look up industrial hemp and see what it does. you know, I agree with you. And I think that, you know, it may not matter. You know, they may be aware of the optics and in the end, they think it doesn't matter. And that's why they don't care.
But see, I mean, but in the context of you've been accused of voter suppression, right? It's just this is just a pile on for people to think that maybe you perhaps are rigging the election in your favor.
I'm going to tell you what I think they're thinking. Oh, they say that every election and it's, you know, people don't think it's true, so we're not going to deal with it.
So one note on how divisive this issue is. The Democratic Party of Georgia released a poll by a left-leaning polling group, so take it kind of with a grain of salt, but even that poll showed Georgians almost completely split. It was like 45-44 or 46-45 on the issue of whether Kemp should step down. So even a Democratic poll showed
it. That's a C-plus polling group that was really wrong on things like Challis Montgomery, way off.
But even that polling group, a left-leaning polling group, had it as split, not as an overwhelming favorite.
I will say, Loretta, that our Facebook Live family, because that's what they've become, an awful lot of them really comment on this repeatedly. They think that Kemp should have recused himself a long time ago. And I keep saying, yeah, that seems to have made sense some time ago. He can't do it now.
Right. I mean, it's going to be what it is through the election.
Although he could have said, yes, I'll step out if there's a recount.
He did have an opportunity there.
Right. And my feeling is that whatever the outcome is of the election on November 6th, that may dictate actually what happens in a runoff, right? Because we have got a number of lawyers watching this election, right, on both sides. And so this is good. There's a lot of scrutiny here. There is no reason to believe that that this is not going to be handled in a judicious manner and in a proper manner and in a fair manner, ultimately.
Let's hope that perception is shared by voters of the state, because if we come away from this election a feeling in any way that it hasn't been legitimately run, It's very dangerous for all of us, obviously. So we'll watch and see how that turns out. Stephen Fowler, we're going to take another break, but thank you. But you had a good time last night covering this debate, didn't you?
There's plenty to cover, especially when, again, a fire alarm goes off 5 minutes in.
But did you notice Greg was not fazed at all?
Well,
the camera was right on you. I was watching you, and you're like,
I thought it was a phone call at first. I thought it was Lisa's phone going off.
All right. Let's do this. Again, thanks to Stephen Fowler for being with us. We still have a little time left. Let's come back and talk about a couple of congressional debates that took place here in our studios and that will air on GPB tonight. You're listening to Political Rewind.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Dano. He played a teen preacher in There Will Be Blood, a moody teenager who took a vow of silence in Little Miss Sunshine, and portrayed Brian Wilson in Love and Mercy. Dano directed and co-wrote the new film adaptation of Richard Ford's novel Wildlife, which stars Jake Gyllenhaal and Carey Mulligan. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB and gpbnews.org.
We're back on Political Rewind. Loretta, yes. You started to ask me something while we were off the air. Ask it on the air.
Well, I've just noticed and then in the Twitter sphere that there's a great deal of concern about a moment in the debate in which Stacey Abrams stated that she helped pass a street gang bill during the 2016 legislative session. That was House Bill 874, sponsored by Burt Reeves of Cobb County in the House and Judson Hill of Cobb County in the Senate. And she indicated that she helps pass that bill. In fact, she voted against it twice.
I see that Greg Bluestein is already going to search this.
Well, I have it right here because, like the old reporter that I used to be, I wanted to verify that before bringing it up. And so you do. You do have it. You know, it was pretty much along partisan lines, even the vote. There was a few members of both sides that, you know, crossed over. But, you know, it looks like pretty much the Democratic caucus voted against that bill both times, when it was first passed in the House and then when it came back amended from the Senate.
All right. Here's what I'd love to do with that. I'd love to make sure we'll talk to the Abrams campaign and see if there's any confusion about which vote is which. You know, because I'd like to get to the bottom of that. Wouldn't you, Bluestein?
Yeah, and I'll put out a call to them soon on
good,
that one, too.
Good. All right, and we'll report back on that. Before we get off the governor's, you asked another question that's pertinent, especially because it's going to come up in the special session. You got one-word answers. Will you support an effort to have legislative approval for a jet fuel tax bill that would relieve airlines from paying that tax? Now, everybody talks about it in terms of Delta because, of course, they're going to be the biggest winners, $40 to $50 million. But this is also important for for
Southwest,
Hartsfield as a hub, because it'll apply to all the airlines, and other cities are already doing it, right?
Yeah, this is an important issue because this was at the center of the big NRA, Delta, mm-hmm. Casey Cagle, giant rift earlier this year that got so much national news. It obviously was killed during the session. Governor Deal signed a temporary executive order basically relieving airlines of this tax. But when he called the special session, and the special session is for hurricane relief, which all the candidates, no one can disagree with. It's about $100 million worth of hurricane release. But the Constitution is set up so that lawmakers also have to take up executive orders that were signed in the interim after the legislative session is over with. And so lawmakers will have the chance to accept or reject this Delta tax break, this airline tax break. It was at the center of all this controversy just a few months ago. And so we had both Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp saying they supported it. Stacey Abrams has always supported it, but Brian Kemp, this is a bit of a shift, because way back when in February, when this whole controversy started erupting, Brian Kemp said unequivocally he would oppose it. And he actually called Delta and other, in his words, corporate cowards who were, you know, diving into this gun control debate. Now he said that he has reassessed it, thanks to some more information about the competitiveness issue, that other states don't have this tax, and he's all on board.
Take that shotgun off your lap, Brian Kemp. All right, let's move on. The special session is coming. Oh, you want to get a word in?
Well, on something else, too. I was just looking at the text of what Abrams said regarding that that gang bill.
Go ahead,
she
Audrey.
Said she helped pass it. She didn't say she voted for it. She said she helped pass it, which means she could have exerted some influence, you know, in her leadership role. Even though she might not have supported it, she, in the end, could have changed her mind at some point. Yeah. But the language.
But her caucus voted against it, so she would have influence with her caucus.
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely worth our pursuing, and I think we will try to get an answer. So thank you for bringing that up. Andre, let me turn to you if I can. I was watching the taping of the 6th District Congressional mm-hmm. debate. Lucy McBath, of course, challenging Karen Handel. And I realized I hadn't given much thought to this. Lucy McBath, in many ways, is a very different kind of candidate. And her appeal is very different than I think a lot of other candidates running in this cycle in a lot of races. Because, obviously, one of the things she showcases is the fact that she lost her son to gun violence. And it strikes me that, in many ways, and she's got problems. I mean, and we're going to talk about them into what Karen Handel went after on yesterday. But in many ways, this is a mother running for Congress in the aftermath of a great tragedy. And although that race seems to be leaning Handel, I'm wondering whether we think that image of a mother running for Congress, how do you view that? It is different.
It's different. It's not unprecedented.
No, of course.
So think of Patty Wetterling in Minnesota. So, I mean, there have been instances where mothers or widows have been activated by the tragic loss of their loved ones to public advocacy and then to try to run for office. It hasn't been successful, I mean, in Wetterling's case. And so we'll see whether or not it would actually be successful in McBath's case. I think, you know, unfortunately, the tragedy gives her a platform and gives her a certain level of name recognition on which to base a candidacy. The problem in this particular case is the risk of being pigeonholed as a one-issue candidate, particularly in an issue that is not that won't resonate entirely across the particular district. And so McBath's challenge is to try to demonstrate that she is a policy wonk on other types of issues and that she can talk about other types of things.
Right. At the same time, we should point out that in the debate that was taped yesterday, Loretta, Karen Handel went after her pretty aggressively about this issue of where does she really live? I mean, she and her husband moved to Tennessee for a period of time. During the time they were up there, and he became, I think, a registered voter up there, they continued to file for homestead exemptions in Cobb County. She says very cleverly, you don't have to it's not illegal to not live in the district you want to represent, referring back to Ossoff, but it is illegal to try to take a homestead exemption if you're not living in that home. And this, boy, deja vu all over again, in a way.
In a sense, and it's a little bit different in that, you know, there are other allegations here because it's illegal to do what is being implied here. And the fact that they have their cars registered also in Tennessee. And I think what was unfortunate was, you know, Lucy McBath in her responses got a little bit tangled up, but she also, you know, didn't have a counter to Karen's questions or even follow-ups from the media during the debate in which to have a clear story about actually what happened in a timeline. And so that really worked against her. And her, and, you know, to Andra's point, her response to things was that Karen, you know, what didn't come back on policy issues, often it was more coming back at her as a politician.
Yeah, Greg, I think we have seen, anybody who's watched that campaign it from whatever distance has seen, McBath is learning to become a candidate. She is not quite as skillful a professional political candidate. And that leads, I think, to some of the issues she has that Loretta's talking about.
And that's part of her strength, too. She's never really portrayed herself as that. She's a first-time candidate who is driven in part to run because of her son's death.
Right.
And she's tried to, as Professor Gillespie said, she's tried not to make this a one-issue type of a candidacy. She talked about abortion, tax policy. A lot of her advertisements, even from the Everytown Guns Group, aren't about guns. They're about taxes and the economy.
But they are so vague. Yeah. And that's the problem. Yeah. They are just so vague. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I think that this is, you know, that if it turns out that she doesn't win this race, I think people will point to her inexperience as sort of something that was a liability for her.
All right. We are virtually out of time, but we just got some news in that I want to share. And it comes from your colleague over at the AJC, Tyler Estep, who says a federal judge intends to issue an injunction barring Georgia election officials from tossing absentee ballots and absentee ballot applications without giving would-be voters advance notice and a chance to rectify any issues. This is the case that was in front of the federal court yesterday, in which the ACLU and other litigants said, we think that people are being barred from getting their absentee votes cast and voting and getting registrations accepted illegally. And the judge, I'm not quite sure what effect it's going to have, but we'll be looking at it and talk about it again later.
And remember, this is one of at least five lawsuits. Yeah. There's actually one or two more by now. They could or could not be ruled on by the court system between now and 13 days from now.
The order would give rejected absentee voters a chance to appeal. Part of the problem has been that a lot of these rejected voters say they didn't have any notice that they were rejected or why they were rejected. And so they feel they don't have recourse. So that's a developing story, and we'll see how it goes. All right. We are completely out of time for today's show. Audrey Haynes, Loretta Lepore, Andra Gillespie, Greg Bluestein, thank you so much for a great conversation about the governor's debate and all the other things we talked about. We're back on Friday at 2:00. Look forward to seeing you all then. Have a great afternoon.